The Bell, the Book, and the Candle by Halford E. Luckock.
It's a wonderful privilege to me, after 25 years of being associated with the disciples who have been at Yale, bothered me a good deal. I've said this in other gatherings at Methodists and Presbyterians and other breeds without the law. The 25 years I've been there, the finest preachers we have had have been the disciples' preachers. Now, that is true. I don't know why it is, why the Lord's been that way. Possibly the disciples are a tough crowd, and they need better preachers than anybody else. I'm perfectly sure I've had scores of men. I know the first words they ever said in their lives were, "In the third place, brethren." It's been a wonderful experience to me to have been here at this convention, to be heartened and quickened by it. Now, for just a few minutes, I'd like to drive dominate your imagination in my way a kind of a framework that may put the task that we have together in the church and the gospel, the reliances that are ours in the form of the old framework, the way in which the priests of the Middle Ages, the reliances they used to exorcise evil spirits and witches, the bell, the book, and the candle. That takes us back into a strange world of magic and superstition by which those instruments were used to cast out evil. The bell was the little bell used in the Mass. The book, of course, was the Bible. And the candle was the candle that burned before the altar. We have a vision of the one using the words in the Jack d'Avrines. He said the cardinal rose with dignified look and called for his candle, his bell, and his book. Just loose the check rein of your imagination, will you, this morning for a moment. The reliance of the preacher and the church today in casting out evil, whether it is in the life of one person or in a world of 2.5 billion people. But the bell was used in marking the presence of God. In the Roman Catholic Mass, it's a tremendously important moment, moving moment, to anyone who can accept the Roman theory of the Mass, that at the elevation of the host, a little bell rings, indicating the presence of God to convey the sense of God that makes worship something more than just a public meeting, saying, "Surely God is in this place." We have a common phrase we use about any public performance. We say of a person, "He rang the bell." There's usually a vulgar connotation to it, meaning he wowed them or he laid them in the aisles or did something like that. But there is a high sense to ring the bell, to communicate the reality of God. And if we do not communicate the sense of God, it does not make much difference what else we do. God is our reliance and compulsion. To communicate that sense of the Ancient of Days, for that's the only thing that can meet the need of the newest today, newest of days. A friend I'd known many years ago came to me out in Chicago after a meeting, and she said, "I wish you had time to come down to our church." He said, "We have the most up-to-date church in the world. We have inner springs on the cushions." I'd hate to preach in church like that. It's bad enough when they're sitting on hard benches to keep them awake. The only up-to-date church in the world is the church that has not a load of didactic advice or just a comment on the news, but has the dimension of eternity. That is the world. That is the world's need. The biggest thing we can do is to bring people that sense in an age which is close to despair, that sense of undergirding and direction. It's not only the preacher, but it is the psychologist who is saying this. One of our notable psychiatrists, Harry Stack Sullivan, says in the Interpersonal Theory of Psychiatry that the deepest problem of people today is loneliness, isolation, and the difficulty of self-esteem in our society, which is so largely an impersonal society. He says that whereas the chief problem in Freud's early days was sexual repression, and in the 1930s it was disguised utility, he says the middle decades of the 20th century show that we're moving into an age of loneliness where the individual person is being devalued. Here's a picture, I think, found in a poem published just a few weeks ago. Much of the need of our age, a little volume of poems called The Love Letters of Phyllis McGinley. I think it meets pictures the need of our time. The mood of uncertainty and fear that has been vividly expressed. Pictures a love letter, calls it mid-century love letter of one person saying to another, we have only our human love, nothing else. Here are a few lines. Stay near me, speak my name, oh, do not wander by a heart's span. Heart's impulse from the light we kindle here. You are my sole defender, as I am yours in this precipitous night. We have just our burning selves to shelter. Huddle against me, give me your hand to hold, for there is nothing else. And I think in a remarkable way that's an echo of another poem, love poem, that might be called a mid-century love poem of the 19th century, the familiar words of Matthew Arnold's Dover Beach. You remember one said to another then, our love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy nor love nor light, nor servitude, nor peace, nor ease of pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept by confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. Now, of course, it's true, in such a time so near to despair, that two heads are better than one. Two hearts that reach out to one another are better than one. But the human love is not enough. Here is the mid-century love letter for the middle of our 20th century, the only adequate love letter. God so loved the world that he gave. That is something to sing about, so we sing about it. Oh, love that will not let me go. That is our message, and we can give it with a renewed confidence just by an observation of history. I listened to reading scriptures a few weeks ago. One struck me with a wonderful force. I'd never thought of before, where Jesus went back to his native Nazareth to preach, and they didn't like what he said. He disturbed them too much, and they were going out to push him over a cliff, make an end of him. And then we read, Jesus, passing through the midst of them, went on his way. That was not only an incident in Nazareth, it was a history of 1900 years. Again and again, men have thrown a roadblock around Jesus saying, this is as far as this man and his influence is going to go. I don't know whether any of you have ever been in a roadblock. I've been in one. It's a tremendously impressive thing. You get stopped. driving up through Indiana. There'd been a bank robbery a little distance away, and there was a roadblock on the road, and I was stopped. And the local constables paid me the greatest tribute was ever paid me in my life. They searched me for $10,000. I helped. But we didn't find anything at all. You let your mind run back over the centuries, and you see the roadblock there in the first few centuries of persecution. This infernal nuisance of Judea's gone far enough, we'll make an end of it with all the persecution. And Jesus, passing through the midst of them, went on his way. It was so in the age of the Enlightenment, John Wesley went to church in St. Paul's Cathedral about 1744 and found 18 people there on Christmas morning. They'd come to the end of it all. And then came the evangelical revival, followed by the great missionary revival. And Jesus, passing through the midst, went on his way. So we can say with all the things that are around us, with all the difficulties, with all the problems, Jesus, passing through the midst, goes on his way. Now, we need to convey that sense of the dimension of eternity in our preaching. Thank God you're working against what is one of the two substitutes of religion of today that are deadly, I think. One of them is the cult of comfort. Religion dwindling down from the eternal God and his will and reformation into a kind of a weak whine which asks, is everybody happy? A purveyor of happiness. I've known ministers who seem to have been preaching for the last 10 years on peace, poison, power, and perpetual possession. Psychology substitute for religion. I told somewhere of one woman under an up-to-date psychological preacher who got the impression that psychosis and neurosis were two women in the New Testament to whom St. Paul sent his greetings. Just as he sent them to Tryphena and Trifosa. Tragedy when psychology of any kind, instead of being a servant of religion, becomes a substitute for religion. And they lose out that tremendous word, take up your cross and follow me. Just ask that question of happiness. I saw a picture of it the other day in the native of the church of the French translation of one of the popular pep books which are substituted for the gospel. It was Dale Carnegie's book, How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. Translated into French, and the title came out this way, Triomphez de vos soucis, vivez qui le diable. Well, you don't get that in my New England accent and the French, but being interpreted, it means this. Overcome your troubles. Live. What the devil? Well, that's a pretty thin religion. And we will not have any adequate religion without the bell. The other symbol is the one that I used to wonder what work of supererogation meant. Because as a young Methodist, I was told that I believed I was against work of supererogation. The only greatest work of supererogation that I think of is talking to a company of disciples ministers about the Bible. You people invented it. You wrote the words in music. Now, when they cast out evil spirits, the priests of the Middle Ages, I don't know what they did. They just probably showed the book. It was magic and superstition. But with us, it is not magic, but power. We have the old question that often happens. What book would you take if you were going to spend the rest of your life on a desert island? I think it's a very bright man said if I was going to be on a desert island, I would take the Boy Scout manual. The Bible is a book for the desert island. Because in many real ways in our time, we are on a desert island. And our reliance is the Bible. You often seen a thing where a movie is made out of a book, where first you see the closed volume, and then in the picture the pages open and you see the characters of the book walk out of the Bible. And one of the book, the one I remember best, is David Copperfield, where the covers were unclasped and the pages opened, and out walked Wilkins Micawber and Betsy Trotwood and Ham Peggotty and David himself. But there's a greater experience than that. That every preacher knows, thank God, people walking out of the book. People whose lives have been shaped by the book and quickened by the book. New creatures saved by the book. And today we need that book in this problem we all have of keeping faith in an alien culture, the problem that the exiles in Babylon had of keeping their faith in an alien culture, and we are in an alien culture. I told a group the other night something I saw in Chicago a few weeks ago. Advertisement of a bank, a big bank window, and in it was just one object, a bank book, and under it it said, the infallible book. Well, my bank book's not infallible. Perhaps yours isn't either. There is only one infallible book. Not infallible as a encyclopedia of science. My father was a minister. St. Louis once looked out the window and saw a little boy with a gimlet boring a hole in a telegraph pole. He put in a nail and hung a little bucket on the pole. He'd been up in the maple sugar country and he got sap in the bucket. And he wanted to get sap out of the telegraph pole. My father went out and asked him what he was doing. He says, waiting to get some sap. He said, well, the telegraph pole wasn't put up to give sap, but to carry messages. The Bible was not put up to be an encyclopedia of science, chemical formulas, or geology, but to carry God's message to men. And it is the message that we need. And we need it so desperately. We talk about juvenile delinquency. But you know what's happening? It's just that so many of our values are catching up with us. We trusted in violence. We still trust in violence. Should we be too greatly surprised if people take to violence? We've trusted in things. We have a passion for things. Should we be too greatly surprised if young people think that getting things is the main purpose of life? They've watched us too closely. A minister, a missionary, home missionary, working up in the East Harlem district, where the prevalence of gambling on numbers is so prevalent, even down to the children. He says, in his parish, the children, many of them no longer say, now I lay me down to sleep, but they repeat this prayer. Now I lay me down to slumber, I pray the Lord I hit the number. If I should die before I wake, put 50 cents on 308. Well, now we may smile at that, but that is part of the genius of our civilization. Doesn't come out of the book. I went to the World's Fair. Oh, it is a marvelous irony that just a few minutes before the Second World War broke out. We had in New York City an exposition called The World of Tomorrow. One of the striking things I remember that World of Tomorrow was going down the avenue and seeing down at the Evans Avenue my gigantic cash register made out of wood. I could only think of the scripture. And I saw the cash register high and lifted up, and its train filled the temple. Well, it does. And there is our other substitute religion, that with the book as our instrument we are fighting the substitution over large areas inside of the church as out of it of a reactionary economics as a real substitute for the gospel of Jesus Christ. We have the cult in these days of Christianity in a vacuum that doesn't really touch any of our great and burning social qualities, our social problems. Doesn't mean much. Now, we're seeing this in the last few years. Always when the boys in the back room get together to keep the church from any vigorous witness in social action, they always take a pious title. In the Methodist Church, we have again and again a committee on social emphasis. Spiritual emphasis, I mean. It's always spiritual. We call it our spiritual mobilization. Now, in the Methodist Church, we have this cult of reactionary economics by a group that call themselves, you won't believe this, but they do, the circuit riders. I'd like to see some of those fat boys on a horse. Circuit rider. And we need to know this. I think the pendulum is swinging. Have it said to us in the church that if you have anything peculiarly Christian to say about our world today, for God's sake, say it. But if you have nothing else but what's echoed in every chamber of commerce in the land, for God's sake, keep still. I think that's true. Old words fall out of the old book. We must obey God rather than man. We need to test our world by Jesus' concern for people. For whenever he said that word, look, it was always a person. His disciples said, look at the building. To them, it was as wonderful a thing in Jerusalem as the Miami Beach skyline. But when Jesus said, look, he saw a person. A poor widow. Someone breaking an alabaster box. And whenever we go out in our world to say, look, we must see the effect of our life in people. It's a wonderful word of T.R. Glover's that we can lean our hearts up against. T.R. Glover says, four words destroyed slavery for whom Christ died. And it is our hope that those same words will in time destroy segregation and discrimination. Men used a phrase, my thing in the other day, he said to another man, the man is traveling experience, he says, it just made me jump out of my skin. Kevin says, that might be a good idea. And it is a Christian idea to jump out of your skin. Get under the other man's skin. Find out where the burdens of life cut cruelly and rest heavily on him. And so I'm pleading that you go on the way to give our whole message an emotional drive that possibly we haven't had. Now, I think I've told this to some of our students. Please don't get up and say I've heard that before. Several years ago, we had a fire in Battelle Chapel in Yale University. I'm sorry to say it wasn't while I was preaching. Just a little fire in the chapel. And the secretary of the dean, or the chaplain, Mr. Lovett, went and knocked very timidly on the door and said, "Mr. Lovett, I'm awfully sorry to disturb you, but I think the building is on fire." And I said, "God forgive me, I've preached too many sermons like that." The building is on fire. Preaching is not explaining anything. Persuading somebody to do something, and I'm pleading. Oh, I'm a reactionary. I'm pleading for a dogmatism about our gospel that is what the world needs. I got a lesson down in Knoxville, Tennessee a few years ago. I was driving through the city, and it was hard enough to get on the city with things parked on both sides. Well, I heard the most awful noise that a stranger in a town can hear, a siren on a fire engine. I kept on going and going for a little while, and the fire engine came nearer and nearer and nearer. I don't want to make this a horror story, but I'll tell you one thing that did not happen. The fire engine did not stop, and the driver got out courteously and come up to me and said, "I see you're a stranger in our city. If it's not too much trouble, could you draw over to the side a little bit so we can go on?" It was the most dogmatic little fire engine I ever heard in my life. It said, "Get out of the way. Everything in this city is at stake." So I drove up into a plate glass window. I didn't drive in it. I was just adjacent to it. That was all. God grant that we may go on, for we have the one source of survival in a world where everything is at stake. Now, I've talked about 20 minutes too long. The last thing is the candle. The reliance in the sense of that wonderful word in Proverbs, the spirit of man is the candle of the Lord. Our chief reliance is the lighted personality of the preacher and the church fellowship. There was a time that I can remember when electricity was measured by candle power. A light bulb was of so many candle power, and the ministry and the church is still measured by candle power. The spirit of man is the candle of the Lord. And our ministry depends not by what we can do, but by what we are. And that makes it the most difficult of all callings. But the first thing about preaching is not cleverly chosen and fitted words, but a divinely chosen and fitted man. Think the other day of a phrase you often hear in connection to ministry. It too has an effort of vulgarity to it. Person's going to go far in the ministry, and we ask what you mean by that. Many years ago, back in the Stone Age, when I was ordained to the ministry, a Methodist presiding elder laid his hand on my head and after the ordination and expressed the hope that I would go far in the ministry. The next day was Monday when the appointments were made, and he saw to it that I did go far in the ministry. I went to Orient, Long Island. If I'd gone any farther, I'd have been in the Atlantic Ocean. There is a real meaning in the phrase. To go far in the ministry means to go deeply into the Spirit of our Lord and his revelation. And it means a candle is the lighted church. Years ago, in a routine question at the beginning of the year in the Divinity School, I asked a student what denomination he was. He drew himself up and said, "I am a high church Methodist." I shuddered. I just got a picture of him going around sprinkling holy water on everything and genuflecting and lighting candles. But after all, we ought to be high church Christians, High churches, thank God you are. High church disciples. People who put the church high on their list of priorities. I spoke last night of being at Cornell University 2 weeks ago, and a very fine, courteous professor was in a little group, and he was very frank with me. He said, well, it's nice to have you and so forth. But he said, the church, he said, is washed up. He said, it won't be very long till it's just a little company on a side street singing ditties about heaven. I said, thank you. That was beautifully said. I said, you have just described the most powerful force in all history. That's what it was. A little company of people on a side street singing ditties about heaven. They began in the upper room. And they have gone. Little company in Leiden, Holland, singing ditties about heaven. That's our calling. Now I'm going to give you some sermons and then I'll quit, because you'll be at the convention and you'll get back and you'll have to get up a sermon in a hurry. This church is a candle too. I never forget the wonderful phrase that somebody used during the Blitz in London when dropping bombs and something went wrong with the electric lighting. They thought St. Paul's Cathedral was on fire because every light in it was blazing. He said it was just there as a single blazing torch. Well, that's what the church ought to be. Here's where you start on church religious education. The Bishop of Scotland, a Bishop of London, was up in Scotland on a holiday. Out in his gaiters, walking over the hills, and he met a shepherd with a large flock, and he walked all in with him. Walked, and he said playfully to him, he says, you know, I'm a sort of a shepherd, too. The shepherd looked at him doubtfully, but just said, is that so? Finally said, how many sheep do you have? The Bishop of London said, oh, about 1 million. After a little while, the shepherd said, what do you do at lambing time? It's a good question for any church. What do you do at lambing time? What do you do with that great flood of young life that God has sent through your buildings and through your fellowship? And then the parting gift is this. I've told it before, but I've told it, I think, across the country. But I like it. I think it ought to be printed in the Bible. It's too late for that now. This is my true story. A familiar one, probably to all of you. A little institution in the city of Philadelphia called Leary's Bookstore. It's been there over 100 years. Nestled right up to the great store of Gimbel's. And naturally, Gimbel's want that property to complete their store. They made a fabulous offer to Leary's a few years ago, and Leary's refused. They couldn't understand it. But they wanted so badly, they doubled that, so the offer was just fantastic. And Leary's again refused, and then Gimbel said to Leary's, for heaven's sake, what's the matter with you? He says, you could take that money and be on Easy Street. Leary's said, we don't want to be on Easy Street, we just want to stay on 9th Street. And they did. And they're there today. As I look out over this thrilling company, I know there is not one church represented here that could not be on Easy Street if it wanted to. Just throw off the burdensome obligations for others. Just be careful about what you say so you don't irritate or antagonize anyone else. Thank God the evidence of this convention is that you do not want to be on Easy Street, but just to stay on Main Street, preaching the eternal gospel of the eternal God.